whole thing, his entire setup. He like lives off of $40,000 a month, but his YouTube channels, I think, are going to, like, his net worth is probably well over $10 billion at this point. And it's that core concept. Every dollar he makes, he just pushes it back into the YouTube channel. I mean, it's his way of bringing education, bringing laughs, bringing fun, bringing entertainment to people. And it's, you know, he's found that way to just, you know, to leave a beneficial imprint on society by just like taking money, putting it back in, taking money, putting it back in. And, you know, from my past that we kind of briefly talked about, I've seen that, you know, pursuing these material things, whether it's women, whether it's money, whether it's fancy clothes or jewelry, it's a dead end. I mean, there will always be a nicer one, and it's not going to bring you that everlasting fulfillment that you're looking for. And so I think maybe there's been a catalyst of me that has probably, I don't want to say been resentful of money, but at least not pursued it as an ultimate goal because of that aspect of like, I know this isn't going to be worth it in the long run, but just because this isn't the thing that is going to be worth it in the long run doesn't mean that it can't support the thing that is going to be beneficial in the long run.
That's exactly right. And the art of making the reasons in the process of figuring out how to make the money we need to do the work that we were born to do, one overcomes one's own limitations. And that is true wealth. And that's the wealth that when we die, we still have it. That's the wealth that makes us feel richer than kings, regardless of what the bank account is. And if we keep trying to tune in and are creative and keep working at it, we'll probably also be supported by the universe. And if not, we'll have to figure out why. But we'll keep going. You know, in the position that I'm in now, I never lived as a grown-up anywhere outside of the ashram. I was 22, 24 when I moved in, but 18 when I started this life, really. And I've just been part of Ananda the entire time. And I am of a caste, so to speak, in a sociological sense, where I could have made money if I wanted to. And, you know, I have lots of abilities that I could monetize. The only reason I didn't become well-to-do is because I chose to do something else. And in my case, very deeply, I chose to serve God instead and serve the divine cause to which I'm dedicated, which is Yogananda's work, Kriyananda's work. And so every so often, because also the other part of this is one has to have, what this also helps develop is faith. Real faith in God, not just I believe, but real faith that says, whatever comes, I accept with gratitude because I know it comes from thee. But I've had to reason it out at different times. Most of the time, I've never given a thought to money. I've been part of an entity that has supported me. I've never been on my own entirely. But more recently, I'm not on my own. But nonetheless, the issue comes up. But I said, the only reason I don't have money is because I chose to work for God. And if God decides to, as one of my friends said, to put me under a bridge and with a thin blanket at the end of my life, well, you know, I've given my life to God. And if that's the end of it, fine. But it's not because I've been lazy. It's not because I've refused to be practical. It's not because I've been looking for a free ride. It's because I chose a direction that did not inherently bring money. And I would do it all over again. I'm not at the end of my life yet, but I'm closer to the end. And however it comes out at this point, my faith could easily be tested. My stalwartness could easily be tested beyond what I am now. Frankly, I hope it is because I'm not finished. But I feel, this is what I'm trying to say. I have a clear conscience. I feel like that all the decisions I made as best I was able. Now, bear in mind, there's a little mantra that I use here. Even if it turned out to be really stupid, it seemed like a good idea at the time. So I always did the best I could with the understanding I had at the time. And I have a very clear conscience. And having a clear conscience is not that far away from having faith. Because if it's been right every step of the way, yeah, the step after has to also be okay. Because if it was right up until now, what do you expect? I mean, I've worked hard at that because, believe me, there's been a lot of reparations to make along the way. You make them, then you go to peace again.
I think that's a beautiful way to look at it. Because I was recently talking to a buddy who at jiu-jitsu, and he brought up, you know, he was talking about how like there were things that he felt bad about and how things were. And someone said something to the effect of, you know, don't be hard on yourself because you made the best decision you could. And it like clicked with me. I was like, yeah, you literally made the best decision you could. And it's almost as if like that's what we're doing every single decision we make, because we don't have God. We aren't God. We don't have that infinite. Of course, we're pursuing it and looking for it, but looking for him, but we don't fully have his intelligence, his wisdom, his awareness. And so in every single decision we are making, it is literally the best decision that we can make. And I guess maybe there's a caveat that you want to get away from suffering and you want to get closer to bliss. I assume that caveat underlies everyone, but I don't know. Maybe there's people who don't.
Everyone seeks to avoid suffering and to find happiness. This was Yogananda's first book, The Science of Religion. Everyone, every sentient creature, go to a worm and poke it with a pin. It'll try to get away from the pin. Give a rat a place where it can get food and it'll go for the food. Every sentient being seeks to escape suffering and to find happiness. However, I'm interrupting you, but let me just finish thought. But we have very different ideas of suffering and happiness. And that's why people behave so. Some people think, if I hurt you, I'll feel happier. You know? And that's wrong, but they don't know it. But their motivation is to feel better, not worse. Now finish what your thought was.
I think that was a great point to kind of interject, because I was kind of looking at it from that lens of, you know, we see people that do awful things. I mean, I don't want to name drop, because I'm not sure that I've made it to a spot where I'm impervious to freedom of speech at this point. So I'll try to be as obscure as possible with these names, but there are people in positions of power who have made billions of dollars off of things like going to war or toppling regimes or certain countries and killing millions and millions of people. Mm-hmm. And I guess there's a piece of me that finds it difficult to think that there would be a human being. And I guess I'm kind of trying to tee you up with this, but there's a piece of me that feels like it'd be difficult for me to believe that they think that they would eliminate suffering by casting that onto other people. Or is that kind of just where their state of consciousness is, that they're not completely out of that lowest caste system in order to see that toppling governments, killing millions, bombing millions, it's not going to bring them everlasting joy?
They're in the second caste. They're trying to find happiness by controlling the world and making it what they think it should be. You know, what they're trying to do is if I'm powerful and I have the force of life or death, and I can eliminate all my enemies just by killing them, and I can impose my thoughts on the world and everybody fears me, look how happy I am doing that. Every decision everyone makes, no matter what it looks like from the outside, inside of them, they make that decision because they think it will alleviate their suffering and bring them happiness. And they're misguided. See, this planet is a place where a lot of different vibrations exist side by side. That's one of the reasons this makes this planet both such an unpleasant place to be and such an excellent school, because we're always being confronted by things that are appalling to us. And therefore, it intensifies our resolve to not be like that. Or it motivates us and gives us courage and drive and determination and discipline to combat it. And yes, all those people, and here's the irony of it, you see, someone who has learned enough about how to work with quantity of energy and quality of energy of a certain quality, everything is determined by quantity and quality of energy. So these despots and autocrats and hellacious beings who nonetheless have power have also actually developed quite a few very fine qualities, because if they hadn't, they would never have been able to bring themselves to follow their desires with such success. Their objectives are not going to bring them what they want. So they are in the middle of a cycle where it's going to have to crash, and what will happen is they will have to be on the receiving end. Because the reason you can do those horrible things is because you do not comprehend what the experience is. So you have to experience it. You have to develop compassion. I mean, think about it. You think about the microcosm of your own life. Somebody does something to you that just breaks your heart and is so hard to deal with. But if you're fortunate, you realize, I never want to be the one responsible for causing someone else to feel the way I feel. And then opportunities come where you may be tempted by your own desires or your anger or whatever it might be to dish out what was dished out to you. But you remember, and you just can't do it anymore. That's how compassion is formed. That's how discipline is formed. I can't do that. Even though I'm going to have to give up something I may really want, I just can't do that because it's just too hurtful. So all these people who are doing things that just are unthinkable, Stalin, Hitler, we can name names from the past, they're going to have to go through it. But it won't be like they'll be Stalin in this life and they'll be a worm in the next life, because they also have a lot of momentum of power and manifestation and so on. So it unfolds very slowly. You see, this is the law of karma. And this is why most people don't want to believe in the law of karma. Because if it's true anywhere, it's true everywhere. And it's very, very, very hard to get a big enough perspective where you realize it's just all happening as it has to happen. Not that it's good, bear in mind. A woman friend of mine was betrayed by someone she trusted. And she was suffering a great deal because of that. And she went to Swamiji and she said, "Well, you know, they didn't really do anything wrong. It was just all as it was meant to be." And Swami said, "No, it wasn't. They behaved very badly." He said, "Don't comfort yourself with a lie." He said, "They behaved very badly. But what you have to do is you have to have compassion for the fact that they made a mistake and they're going to have to balance that mistake. You have to recognize that it would never have come to you if there wasn't something for you to learn." You know, there's this, the way I often think of it like is like this. It's like if your palm is painted black and you put the palm of your hand and you cover your eyes, even if you open your eyes, all you'll see is blackness. And this is a lot of the things that go on in this world. They're really, really black. And if you put them over your eyes, then there is nothing but blackness. But if you take your hand and hold it way out in front of you, you'll see the black palm. But even as you look at it, you'll see this whole bigger picture around it, which doesn't change the blackness. It just changes it in proportion to the rest of the story. And the rest of the story is all the karma of the nation, of everybody involved, of the individual doing what they're doing. And then there's one more piece of it, which is really critical, which is, again, for a period of 12 years, every year or every other year, I was part of the leadership when we took 30 Americans, almost always Americans, to India, in years when India was less modern than it is also. And mostly people had never been outside of the Western world. So it was, you know, it was a big trip. We were there for 28 days. And it was so interesting to me that people's reaction to poverty and to leprosy and to disease on the streets and beggars, people had such radically different responses. Some just were absolutely unhinged. And others were perfectly comfortable singing songs with the beggar children, you know, just like perfectly at ease. And I began to realize, because my job on that tour was basically keeping everybody sane and happy, was those people who knew from their own experience that hard times and suffering was a wonderful teacher, and that I myself learned things from the worst things that happened to me that were worth every bit of it that I could never have learned in any other way. In other words, suffering is not without purpose. So we automatically think when we see somebody suffering, that either they're being punished or something awful is happening to them. But what if you realize that this person is going to become so free and happy from this experience? Would I want them to not have that experience? If this is the only way that they can become free and happy, why would I want them not to have it? Why would I be afraid for them? And I think it comes entirely to what we ourselves have been through, how we've come to see it. The palm is still black. That's why Swami said, do not comfort yourself with a lie, but to see it in proportion. Everything that's happened because of it, there's where the soul contract comes in, all these different points. You become, the black is the same size. You become bigger and bigger around it. And that's how you live in this world. There's a lot of black in this world, but I deeply feel and I know that the masters are moving this world where it needs to go. And everyone who is here, regardless of whether our lives are easy or difficult, are having this wonderful opportunity to expand our awareness, to become freer and happier. We're learning what we need to learn. Yeah, it changes everything.
Yeah, and it seems like a piece of that is the suffering. And
yes, unfortunately.
Right. And you even said there that it was, why not let something to the effect of like, let, you know, if this person needs to suffer in order for them to become as free as they want to be. Where I've seen people get tripped up on God, and I think it's a very valid question, which is that if there's a God that exists, the hypothetical question that's always provided is, if there's a God that exists, then why is there evil? Why is there suffering? Shouldn't everything just be bliss and light? So, and what you found, you know, why does evil exist if there is an all-knowing, all-present God in our universe, or that created our universe?
Mm-hmm. Well, Vivekananda answered that question by saying, this is, then I will try to answer it, but he says, the level of consciousness that asks the question cannot comprehend the answer. Because if you don't understand the ways of the divine, you'll never understand them until you've risen to that level. You're asking the question because you don't see it from the right perspective. And I think it's a very clever non-answer, but that is the answer. There's several answers to that question. The first one is, who knows? You know, it's just like, this is the way it is. And the next question is, first, let me correct something because this is bothering me in my mind. Just because you understand that people have to go through difficulties and it may help them, that does not mean that you don't try to ease their suffering. But you try to ease their suffering in such a way that it helps them to expand their understanding and to grow. That doesn't merely, okay, let me phrase it like this. You're actually trying to help them see, because part of the Vaishya consciousness, the second caste, is that your suffering that makes me terribly uncomfortable. You must stop suffering so that I will feel comfortable. And so the actual point of view is my discomfort. And even though it comes out as a certain kind of compassion, it's also you must change in order for me to feel okay. This is parents who overcontrol their children, you know, just all kinds of things that happen. And teenagers are terrific teachers on this, because when mom is really talking about herself and not really talking about her kids, the children always know it. You know, she pretends it's for their welfare, but it's actually, it makes her nervous what they're doing.
Sure.
And the kids can just sniff it out like that. And they just pay no attention to her. So, but if you really working on the Kshatriya level for an ideal, and part of that you understand the nature of reality and you're trying to cooperate with it, you may still dedicate yourself to helping them, but you're really trying to help them. You're not trying to make me feel better by fixing the world. See, it gets very subtle in that. Now, back to the question about why is there shadow at all? Well, by their fruits you shall know them. The ego. And ego is a word that is a bit of a confusing word, but ego is the infinite self identified with limitation. And ego is essential because we have to identify with this body and this life we're living, or else we can't function. But But when we become too defined by our limited experience, then we cut ourselves off from, we have our hand over our eyes to an extent. We're cut ourselves off from the greater reality, which is really what's happening. So the ego wants things to be easy and comfortable. That's just pretty much it, isn't it? Easy and comfortable equals good. And people apply it to the spiritual path. Oh, this is good karma because everything is easy for me and is going well. Oh, this is bad karma because things are very difficult and suddenly nothing is going well. But what we're actually saying is this is easy and pleasurable. This is demanding and difficult. But we've attached one is good, one is bad. But it depends on what our goal is. If our goal is to just be easy and comfortable the whole time and never really have anything happen to us, then good is when that happens and bad is when it's taken away. If our goal is to actually recognize, oh, my consciousness is very limited compared to its potential, I need to develop an infinite consciousness. And in order to do that, a lot of my self-definitions are going to have to be transcended. And oh, I like my self-definitions. They make me feel safe and comfortable. They are familiar. I want to continue as I am. I don't want to get bigger. I don't want to have to let go of these things. I want to blame you. I want you to make it right. I want the world to conform to me. And so if we feel that way, then we constantly resist. So then we say, oh, if God were really going to be nice, he'd make it all easy and pleasurable, wouldn't he? But what would that give us? You know, I mean, are you at your full potential at this point? Or put it more frighteningly, is this my full potential? Oh my God, I hope not. You know, it has to be better than this.
There's got
to
be more.
I do not want to continue as I am. Yeah. So, but I'm not going to work hard enough to change if I'm not suffering a little. Or let me phrase it differently. There's not something pushing me. You know, the light's in front of us. It would be wonderful if we just raced for the light. But what actually happens is we catch fire from behind. We catch fire from behind. And if we know what we're doing, that moves us toward the light and not away from it. And every saint, every master, every scripture says that you might not realize it, but it's happening just the way it should happen. And there is no other way for it to happen. Personally, I think it's a crummy system. What can I say? I've noticed that the worst things that have happened to me have made me so much better than I was before they happened. I get confused as to whether it was good or bad. I don't know what to say. And so that gives me a clue that maybe if my awareness were bigger and my perspective were bigger, I'd see the whole story differently. Mm. At least that's a real possibility to me. I don't stand there. But I realize that when I resent it, see, when I lived with Swami, when Swami Kriyananda was with us, he died 10 years ago, but especially at the beginning, but actually all the way through. Every so often he would say or do things, primarily say, but some occasionally do things that I didn't understand. But I had so much experience of his wisdom and so many experiences of going through a cycle of I don't understand. Oh, now I understand. That I developed the habit actually from the very beginning. But I had to put more on the shelf. I couldn't accept it because I just had too much personal integrity and too much commitment to my own integrity. And he encouraged that. He always said, I prefer an honest argument to a mindless yes. You know, so I gave him lots of honest arguments.
Like that.
Because I couldn't give him a mindless yes. I just couldn't do it. I wasn't raised that way. I couldn't do it. But I couldn't sometimes reject what he said either. Because I'd had enough experience to know that the chances were he was right. And I wasn't. So I just developed a little place where I just put it over here. Like up on a shelf where you put something your aunt gives you that you don't like. But you can't throw it away. So you just put it over there. But over the years, everything. I've just taken everything off that shelf. I've changed. And I said, well, wow, this suits me perfectly. Why haven't I been using it all this time? But I had to take it out of my central view. So, like, why does God create evil is the epitome of, I can't do anything with that idea. So I take it down to where I'm on solid ground. And I'm on solid ground to know that the worst that I've experienced has brought the best out of me. And I know for a fact it never would have happened if the other hadn't happened. And so in my little tiny universe, my suffering doesn't look like a gulag. My suffering doesn't look like an abused child. My suffering doesn't look like a kidnapper. You know, that's not my karma. But so it's not that kind of drama that other people are living, but it's the most I can handle. So if it works in my little microcosm, I have to at least allow the possibility that it's working in everybody else's microcosm, no matter what it looks like to me.
Yeah.
And that also, the Bible says, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. You know, and it goes on to say, don't you worry about it, folks. You know, I've got this covered. I mean, that's essentially what God tells us, which is you don't know what's happening here, but I know what's happening here. This is how Scripture speaks about it.
Hmm.
And yeah, so I watched public figures with power doing things. I mean, and on many occasions, sometimes, truthfully and honestly, I just feel sad for them because I think, whoa, when this karma comes home to roost, you are not going to be enjoying it. You know, and I pray that you can learn what you're supposed to learn because that's what you're doing. Yeah, you're not setting yourself up for things going well. And so there'll be incarnations in which people will feel sorry for that person because it all seems so unfair. You see, this is why karma gets so scary.
Yeah.
You know, really scary.
Well, so then this brings in a very fascinating point that I've been thinking about. I really wanted to ask you this as well. I remember reading, especially an autobiography of a yogi, and I found some other accounts where an enlightened master or guru will at times take on their disciples' karma, and usually it manifests in some sort of way of like of an illness or something like that. And it really got me thinking about my life. And any time that I have experienced physical pain, now I train Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and so there are times where you get hit in the head, you get scratched, maybe pull a muscle, and so there's a piece of me that's like, huh, I wonder if this is me actively finding ways to work off karma. And which instantly brought forth this thought of, there's a guy named David Goggins. I'm not sure if you're familiar. I don't know if you pay attention to his circle. He, fascinating story, very unique study, but he was very much in that first cast of life and has propelled himself physically up into that third cast of the warrior, where he'll run on end, like for days, he'll do these crazy marathons with his body. He'll push his body to the absolute limit. And he's even at a point now where every time he's had to get his knees replaced. So like every time he walks, it's like metal scraping on bone and he's in a ton of pain. Yeah, it doesn't sound pleasurable. But something that he had said whenever he's going through this or like where he's at now is that he's working out his demons. And this really got me to a place thinking like, are we able to work off karma through physical activity, such as working out, doing jiu-jitsu, pushing our body to the most physical extreme? Like, in your opinion, is that a way for us to actively alleviate karma?
Well, of course, it depends on the individual. So it's first thing is, it's not a dogma. Is it possible that you are making profound spiritual progress by doing extreme physical things? Because spiritual progress is you are freeing yourself. Think of karma as a limited idea of reality, and you need to break that limitation. That's, I call it an unlearned lesson, something I don't know about happiness and suffering. Okay, now suffering is in the eye of the beholder. To have my knee hurt merely means that there's physical pain. It doesn't mean that I'm suffering. It just means that there's physical pain present. Suffering is a mental decision based on is a mental decision, not a result of external conditions. So a person could be learning some very powerful lessons about what causes suffering. Let's use the physical body as a very good example. Physical body is temporary. I am the immortal spirit. I am the pattern of energy in my chakras that manifests the physical body. The physical body will die, but the pattern of energy in my chakras will continue. My individual awareness, self-awareness, my knowing that I exist, my consciousness will continue. The physical body will fall off. It will be no more significant than changing your shirt. And that is really what happens. We have all these, you know, death and return experiences now, and that's what people tell us. They just step out of their bodies, but they, the entity, is totally intact. It just enters another dimension. Sometimes it puts the body back on. And so it's quite clear that I am entirely separate from this body. However, most people are incredibly compelled by the body. And therefore, we are allowing ourselves to be defined and ruled, and our happiness and suffering is defined and ruled by what happens to this body. So anything that makes us more powerfully independent of what happens to this body is in itself a very positive consciousness ability to develop. So if in the pursuit of your jujitsu or whatever, or your marathon running, you can separate your consciousness from the physical body and have the energy of your true consciousness persevere regardless of what the body is feeling, that's a powerful spiritual lesson. So in the sense that you've learned, if you've learned a powerful spiritual lesson, you've transcended a certain amount of karma. That's true. Now, there could be circumstances, though, where a person is ready to learn deeper lessons, and they just cling to the physical when it's really time for them to go to learn more subtle lessons in other ways. That's why I say it depends on the individual. But we're often drawn to do extreme physical things because it trains willpower, concentration, courage, intuition, endurance, you know, all kinds of things that are extremely important to learn and to transcend the physical. All of those are great. So yes, that's exactly true. You could learn a lot. That's why, see, this is why does God do what he does? Why does God give somebody cancer? Because very often, a friend of mine who had a terrible throat cancer, and he died relatively young. I think he was in his 50s. He took a lot of treatments for that. The treatments were horrific. He was a devotee and a disciple. But he very, very strong physically, big man, very strong physically, always been very physical in his world. Just like a couple of months before he died, he was talking to me and to others. And he basically said the treatments were so horrific that even though he was incredibly stalwart in regard to his ability to separate his consciousness from his body, it was too much. But he said when he could no longer use the same methods that had served him his whole incarnation, and he was powerless in the face of the pain and the debilitation, it forced him to surrender his egoic will to the divine will in a way that he had never imagined was possible. And what came to him was a joy and freedom he'd never had. And he was right there in front of me. I knew he wasn't a close friend, but I knew him well enough. And he was totally different than I'd ever known him to be. So much more at peace, so much, you know, just everything you would want to be. He didn't live much longer, but he'd done it. So there was a point at which he lost the ability to transcend his body, but in losing it, he gained something that he didn't have otherwise. So that's why it's all directional, you see.
Right. Like it's almost as if it could be directional for a little bit of like pursuing these marathons or jujitsu, but it could also get to a point, and this is what you're saying, it depends on the individual, where you become so overly attached to this thing, this way of being, that it it could, what's the word I'm looking for? Take something grand in order to pull you out of it. So it depends if you're, what your intention is when going into these physical pursuits.
And even more than that, you see, it depends on your consciousness. Depends on what it's actually bringing out of you. I've known, I know a couple of elite athletes, as it happens in the martial arts. Let me think how to say this exactly. Well, they lack, they've lost their common sense about what they're doing. It's just, it's past the point where you're developing anything. This is just, this is not being practical in your idealism. You're throwing, you're throwing away your human body, and your human body should be respected more than that. Really, because you can do that doesn't mean you should do that. Because, you know, life is long, and there's many other things to do. So it just depends. That, right. And that's why you can't make dogmas. It has to be very individual. All true teaching is individual.
Yeah, there's,
as long as it's serving you. As long as it's serving you, and as long as you feel that you're growing on all levels by the effort, keep doing it. But this is, again, you see, intuition. Don't make it into a dogma. Just make it a constant. As long as this seems like the right thing, I'll keep doing it. But what I'm attached to is doing the right thing. I'm not attached to this thing. I'm attached to doing the right thing. When Mother Teresa of Calcutta, who was, you know, serving all the poor people, Mother Teresa started doing that because she was on a train to her school in Darjeeling when she was a nun in India, and Jesus came to her and said, serve the poorest of the poor. Walked out of her convent and started doing it. So now she's talking to a reporter because she's world famous, and he says, you know, a lot of other NGOs can serve the poor better than you and your nuns can serve. You know, what do you think about that? A really stupid Jeez. Question.
Yeah, right.
And Mother Teresa said, I'm not serving the poor. And, you know, the journalist looked really confused. She said, I'm doing what Jesus asked me to do.
Mm.
I don't know if the journalist understood, but it was perfectly clear to me. If Jesus told her tomorrow to, you know, go live in a palace, she'd go live in a palace.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way, mm-hmm. like as a reframe and even just to view it. Because like there's a personal example I'm thinking of, which is I've been tracking on my Instagram story mm-hmm. the number of consecutive days that I've gone to the gym, either to lift weights or do jiu-jitsu. And so mm-hmm. today, I haven't gone yet today, but today will be number 45. And there's a piece of me, the reason I started it was to hold accountability, because I know if I'm putting it out there, it's going to force me to go. Mm-hmm. But the more that I'm doing it, I'm feeling that energy of like, oh, this is kind of cool. Like I'm kind of getting like some positive feedback from it. Uh-huh. And so what I've been very quick to call myself out on is that ego attachment to doing this. And because there's been people who have asked, like, how many days are you doing this for? And I'm just like, I honestly don't know. There's a piece of me that's like, well, 1,000 sounds like a cool idea, but uh-huh. but the crux of it, right, is what I think we're talking about here, which is that I'm kind of just doing it because it feels right to do it. And right. at some level, I'm aligned with a higher power that's guiding me to do such a thing. And mm-hmm. I think deeper, you know, it's weird because whenever it becomes, this almost feels egoic to say, but I want to be able to show people what is possible from the human body. And this is almost what, you know, that reporter was asking with Mother Teresa. It's like, okay, I'm doing this because I'm guided to it, but I also like the reason of showing people what is possible with the human body. And so I think this comes into that hierarchy we're talking about where, well, what is the highest priority? Is it to show people what's possible, or is it because you're being divinely led to this? And I think that's probably where it's like, as long as you can keep approaching it with seeing the good things from it and seeing maybe the pitfalls that could come from it. But as long as you're doing it for that highest acknowledgement, then that's really the only reason you need in order to do things that people might label as being egotistical or center driven, if you will.
They're only egotistical if they are egotistical. People thought that Swami Kriyananda was a great egotist. Some people, I would say, because sometimes he would actually just tell us, well, you know, this last month, I wrote 2 books and I went on a lecture tour and then I had to record this album and then I did this and then I did that. But then he would say, you know, I couldn't do any of it, but I put my attention at the point between the eyebrows and I asked Master to work through me And whenever I thought I couldn't do it, I knew Master could do it. And he was telling us that. And then the next sentence would be, and that's what all of you can do. That which I, Jesus again, that's that which I do, ye shall do in greater things. So it's not a question of egotism, even to just say you're doing it. It's a question of whether you are being egotistical and doing it, not whether it sounds like it or could be. And what the answer to this is, take yourself lightly. Just take yourself lightly. So on the day that you quit, you say, well, that was fun. Now it's over. You know, instead of having this gigantic sense of self-worth and destiny involved with it, what's magnetic, authenticity and humility is so magnetic. It's just so magnetic when people are just the way they are. I have a friend, and she's exactly my age, and we were, we started at Ananda together 50 years ago, and we were both in the monastery at that time. And she's a very, very strong intellectual person and very indifferent to, you know, feminine wiles do not attract her at all. She's just very powerful in her mind. But my hair color is natural, just by the way. I don't dye my hair. I say that because people sometimes accuse me, but she dyes her hair. And she's actually, she's older than I. She still dyes her hair. And I said to her, my dear, when we were in our 20s and we were just renunciates living for God, I would have bet $100 million that when your hair turned white, you would never dye it. And then she just said to me, I would have too. She said, odd, isn't it? Just like that. And that has just become my little motto. Odd, isn't it? I thought it would be different, but it's just how it's turned out. But it's just so like, incredibly attractive to just this. Well, yeah, I thought it would be one way, it turned out another way. Odd, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's a very freeing way.
If you can go 1,000 days, and if the motivation to try to make 1,000 days is healthy for you, then have fun. You know, just drag yourself out there when you have the flu, and drag yourself out there when you have pneumonia, whatever, if it's fun.
Yeah,
but the day that it isn't, then you just say, well, that was fun. We did that. Or the day you realize, oh, this has gotten out of hand and I'm not in integrity on this anymore.
Yeah.
Then you also say, guess what? I'm not in integrity on this anymore. It's over.
And I think there's probably a level of being like in that first cast that we were talking about where you just don't do anything. Uh-huh. But then like, you know, making that push upward and then, exactly. You know, maybe. And then there's some sort of like linkage, like, well, if I stop, then I'm going to go backwards. Like I have to keep going. Otherwise, right. I'm going to go backwards. Did you have
something to
add to
that? Already own what you've done. Yeah. Well, you've proven that you can do it. So you won't fall back again. We don't have to be afraid because you know that it was much more fun to put out the energy than it was to not put out the energy. Hmm. So even if you drop this particular challenge, what you've taught yourself is one, you've taught yourself, I can do it. Which is a big thing. I can do it. And then a piece of you, if you've been careful all along the way, so that was much more fun than just lying on the couch and doing nothing. So what causes suffering and what brings happiness? And then you'll just choose that which brings happiness. Now, bear in mind, the happiness we're talking about is not ease and pleasure. It's the happiness of a clear conscience and a happy heart, an open heart. So sometimes you have to do things that are not easy and not pleasurable, but they make you much more happy than doing things that would be easy and pleasurable.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought this up because I think it's a very interesting point that links in within working out, which is almost pursuing things that will cause a level of suffering. Lifting weights, you're ripping your muscles, you're suffering. Running, you're suffering because you're putting your body to the extreme. Jumping into an ice bath, freezing cold water, you're suffering because you're not supposed to be, in air quotes, in 30, 40 degree water.
Exactly.
So, so like, how does this, I feel like there's some sort of dance that's going on here with this idea of being able to pursue suffering in the short term in order to have a more sustained fulfillment in the long term.
Well, see, the word suffering is the hard word there. That's why I use the word ease and pleasure. But even pleasure is not the right word. Even ease isn't the right word. It's just I know what I'm doing and I know why I'm doing it. And that gives me such a profound satisfaction that no, because it's the eternal versus the transitory, or the lasting versus the temporary. We don't have to go all the way to eternity to make it work. It might be more pleasurable for me to sit home, watch Netflix, and eat ice cream. And so in the moment that I'm doing it, it could be a pleasurable experience, but the lasting effect of that is going to be catastrophic for me. So if I get up and I go and I work out and I come home and I have, you know, a good salad or whatever it might be, the lasting effect of that is so much more satisfying than either the short-term exertion or the lack of collapsing kind of pleasure, you know, sloth, the joy of sloth, you mm-hmm. know, which there's a certain joy in sloth, but it doesn't compare. And then what happens finally is it doesn't even look attractive to you because you've had enough experience that, see, in my own life, because I've lived in such a different way, things that people think are so enjoyable, I just can't bear them. I just can't stand it because the effect it has on my consciousness is so contrary to the effect that I want things to have that if I get anywhere close to it, it just, I can't stand it. I have a very strong dislike of a lot of popular music. It's just, I can't bear it. There was a period of time, this was many years ago, when our meditation center, now we have our own freestanding, beautiful building, but at that time we just rented a few rooms in an office building, actually. And right across the street from us, there was this nightclub, and it was called The Vortex. That's what it was called. Wow. And it was just it was a music club. It wasn't like a real nightclub, but I think it even might have catered to teens. I'm not sure. But it had such powerful, loud bass in that club that you could actually feel it would come under the street and you could feel it on the sidewalk. And sometimes at night, we'd have had some wonderful, you know, meditation or spiritual ceremony. And we'd come out, you know, like at 10:30 or 11 at night because it maybe had been a long evening, standing on the sidewalk and you feel the bass beating under the sidewalk. And I often would ride a bicycle from that center to where I lived. And I got on my bike this one particular night and I went across the street and my route took me by the back door, which was the entrance to that place. And it was swarming with people, just swarming. They were all dressed in black because that was the time everybody dressed in black. So there are all these people, perfectly nice people, dressed in black, swarming to get into that building. And to my mind, if somebody, and I wasn't an old woman then, I was 40 maybe, if somebody had taken me off my bicycle and forced me into that room, it would have been taken to hell as far as I was concerned. Yeah. You know, people drinking beer, drinking wine, getting drunk, listening to this cacophonous music with these pounding bass. It just would have been horrible to me. And they were all just fighting to get in. So taste is very much a matter of vibration, of where you are. And so, I mean, that's just an example. So many people, and even you in a previous time, might have thought this was pleasurable. But when you experience something more subtle and really recognize that it seemed like a good idea at the time, but now I realize that the happiness I get from that is transitory and not what I really want, then this is not at all difficult. It's not difficult and it's not painful. It's just like, wow, I'm so glad that I get the opportunity to do this. Then you also ask the question, when does that stop? You know, how many times can I transcend and transcend and transcend? And this is the spiritual life. That's why it's so interesting. It just keeps you entertained, absolutely.
It is entertaining. So this is kind of bringing me back to almost the conversation maybe of like psychedelics or marijuana in terms of, you know, utilizing these because I briefly told you the audience knows for sure that I've used psilocybin to like as a therapy session and then also ayahuasca. And I'm at a point now where I don't really see I don't have a need to really ever take them again. There is a piece of me that kind of like feels like there's like this almost It has this ability in order for us to see maybe into like the astral realm or something like that. Mm-hmm. And maybe mm-hmm. marijuana also gives us that opportunity or that portal in there. So with that, and then I think on top of that, you know, I've heard people say that, you know, it invokes a lower frequency, but it's, you know, it helps people get out of a lower frequency, but it's not like the highest frequency, and kind of like all this different weird stuff. And all of this to say, like, are these tools like that we can keep using on our spiritual journey? Or does there come a point in time where we just become sober and we just realize that we're not able to touch on subtle energies with these drugs anymore? Or are we still able to use them in order to elevate our consciousness?
You know, I came out of the 60s, so I know a little bit about it. But there was an actual time that this was actually true, that way back in the 60s, when you would try to get across the Canadian border and they would want to search your hippie van for drugs, you could say, oh, I meditate, I don't take drugs, and they would let you through. People would start with drugs, but then realize that what they were seeking was a change. See, what Swami Kriyananda himself, because he was a major spiritual teacher in the 60s in San Francisco when all this was happening. That's where I first, well, in this area. And, you know, he himself said, you know, he's strongly against drugs for reasons I'll explain. But he said, I have to be honest enough to say that I have seen that people have been awakened to the spiritual path because of some chemical experience, that they had a perception that this world is not what it seems, a drug-induced perception that this world is not what it seems. The problem with drugs is super simple. It changes your brain chemistry in such a way, and God alone knows how or why it does it, that it is possible, by no means guaranteed, but it's possible that you will actually have an experience of expanded awareness that actually leads you into an upward moving direction. And that's what the mushrooms can do. That's what all of these things can do. Not always, but it can happen. And that part of it can be a powerful catalyst to help us put our lives into proportion and realize what's important for us. But the problem is, it's chemically induced. It's not an actual disciplined day after day shifting of my own energy pattern by putting out my own energy to create a new energy pattern. It's just giving me a chemical bypass, let's use that word. Even if all of those experiences are, you know, happy and transcendent in themselves, it becomes a kind of spiritual materialism, because the spiritual path is not defined by how many groovy experiences I can have. The spiritual path is by how free I become, how much I can love, and not just love in a, wow, man, isn't that really just terrific? You know, it's on a Jesus Christ kind of level, a Babaji kind of level, Krishna kind of level, where I can stand unshaken amidst the crash of breaking worlds. People, by their fruits you shall know them. People who habitually define their spirituality by the chemically induced trips they take. Do you want to be like them? You know? I mean, I know lots of people like that. I've never seen it that such a person says, oh, you have what I want. I mean, for me, because it's not theirs, really. It's just something that they take. Now, I mean, I was talking to someone I know casually who went to Colombia and took ayahuasca and had a fantastic life-changing experience, you know? So I think it was a very good thing for that person to have done. But interestingly, they've decided not to do it again. They had the opportunity to, you know, do it multiple times, and they just said, no, I saw what I needed to see. And that was enough. Marijuana is a slightly different story than the real psychedelics. My experience is 50 years old, I have to say, and the whole drug scene is different than it used to be. But what I've seen as the result of marijuana is that marijuana systematically weakens your willpower. And part of that is because it gives profound meaning to nothing. I mean, you know, you get a little stoned and you know, you study your eyeglasses and you suddenly see, oh, look at the patterns, you know, like that. And, yeah. I mean, that's at least the world I was in. And you feel like, you know, something really deep is happening. And then you get the idea that, well, one of my friends who was a high school teacher and the kids, because he'd also been through the drug culture, the kids sort of said to him, you know, when has marijuana become a bad thing? He said, when you have a great evening with your friends and you were sober the whole time and you said, wow, that would have been so much more fun if we'd been stoned. He said, then you've gone too far because you've lost the ability to experience life without the chemical. And what the marijuana does, I think, this is my own theory, is that it gives you the illusion of profundity over nothing. And so as a consequence, you don't put out any energy. And also, once again, people who I've met, and I know not that many, because within Ananda, we don't do this. They don't look like anybody I want to be. Because they're just, the dynamism, the power isn't there. And there's a wonderful story in that, I don't know which book it's in, but Richard Alpert, who became Baba Ram Dass, and he and Timothy Leary were the big beginners from Harvard of all of this psychedelics. And he went to India and he met the marvelous Guru Neem Karoli Baba. And Richard Alpert Ram Dass, he gave his guru a whole handful of LSD pills. And his guru ate the whole handful of pills and continued without the slightest change. You know, and it was just like, you think you're having these great experiences, but you don't even know what you're doing. That's what Richard Alpert got from that. He said, this is, you know, I have real consciousness. You're just children. Mm-hmm. And so that's how it can hurt you. Now, I've heard that like psilocybin for post-traumatic stress syndrome, you know, I've heard that it's really been miraculous that some of these drugs have had fantastic effect on people who are suicidally depressed. And I mean, I think that's marvelous, you know, but that's not the same as I'm going to realize God by taking LSD every week.
Right. Right. And yeah, I think it becomes a crutch, it becomes a trap in a sense. And I've seen a lot or heard a lot of people who are like, oh, I've done ayahuasca 50 times now. I can't wait for my next one. And it's like, are you really using it the right way? Maybe you should stop using it. Of course, I'm not in a position to tell them what to do, but there's a piece of me that's kind of like, okay, it seems like you're kind of falling into a trap here, a trap that's making you reliant on a physical thing in order to find what you're looking for, but you're not even finding it because you're still having to go back to that plant medicine or that artificial reality, if you will.
It is. Well, that temporary is the actual word.
Temporary.
You can't walk. You've changed because you have seen another dimension. And so you relate to this world differently. But you haven't necessarily developed the concentration, the discipline, the willpower, the self-control that is required to actually shift the energy pattern in your chakras.
Or you're not even taking action on that in the physical reality. Right. Once you come out of it, like maybe you have that profound experience, but then whenever you return to the physical world, you're not changing anything at all. You're just still doing the same habitual patterns.
Yes, that's exactly true. And then we say all growth is directional. People have to have the experiences they have because nobody learns from being told. We only learn from having the actual experience ourselves. You know, so there you have it. I mean, at least this aberration from what is really helpful to us is the fundamental intention is not nefarious. You know, it's that I'm trying to have a higher experience. I don't think this is going to work for you, but at least that's what you're seeking. Good for you. You know, you're not seeking dominance over people. You're not seeking, you know, evil. you're trying to have an experience, but I don't think this is really going to work for you in the long run. And that's, you know, about the best you can say. You'll figure it out.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. You've dropped a lot of wisdom here, Asha. And I really like that concept of truth being directional. I think that's really a beautiful way to look at it. And it makes a lot of sense, especially the way that you pulled it apart. As a final question, you know, I know we barely know each other, but I feel like you have a lot of wisdom to share. Are there, based on, I don't know, either my questionings, my energy, do you have any final advice that you might have for myself moving forward?
Oh, just keep on doing what you're doing, more and better. I wouldn't presume. No, you're obviously moving in a way that's very dynamic, and that just keep up that dynamism and keep your heart open and keep trying to learn. As long as you remain humble, self-honest, and just do your best, you're clearly Divine Mother is bringing you many opportunities through what you're doing. So I think it's all going to be just wonderful. I will watch your future career with great interest.
I appreciate it, Asha.
And I'm very glad that we met. I've been looking forward to this, and it was as enjoyable as I thought it might be. I'm very grateful for the chance. Thank you so much.
You should know, and
it's very important to say this, everything that I've told you is what Swami Kriyananda taught me. And everything he taught me, he learned from Yogananda. These are not individuals. This is an ancient teaching that's just, by the grace of God, I have the opportunity to be the mouthpiece for it. And to a certain, I mean, I understand. I don't speak of what I don't know. But I've just been extraordinarily privileged to have had the opportunity to learn and then the opportunity to share. And if it's been a benefit in any way, that's just my privilege and my honor. So what joy.
Well, it's super grateful. I'm very grateful for your presence. And this was an amazing podcast that I know I will be listening back to many times, pulling out different nuggets.
Very good. Very good.
So thank you. Do you want to let the audience know if you have any final messages for them, any meta truths that you want to drop on your way out? And then I have some of your links, but if you want to plug some of your stuff, this space is 100% for you.
Well, let me put it this way. This is, you know, as I was saying just a moment ago, I'm the representative of an extraordinary lineage, and the links are easy to find. Asha Naiswami, you'll just find everything. I have a YouTube channel and Instagram and all of that. I've spent decades sharing these teachings. If anything that you've heard me say seems of interest to you, I am really just this tiny window into this infinite possibility. And if you feel inspired, follow it. It will only help you. I'm not looking for converts on any level. As Swami Kriyananda used to say, his only goal is to convert people to their own potential. And if anything looks helpful to you, then by the grace of God, I hope you feel inspired just to take your next step. That's all any of us can do. But if we all do that, then the light will ever increase in this world. And that is worth doing.
Beautiful. Well, it's beautifully put. So Asha, thank you so much for being here. It's truly a pleasure. Guys, thank you so much for listening. Check out her Instagram and her YouTube, because there's some pretty profound wisdom that she drops in like the 30 second to a minute long range. Haven't done the full dive on YouTube, but I can just tell there's going to be gems. I'm already going to go and look for those caste system videos. But that's, yeah, it. Just to wrap it up, Asha, thank you so much for being here. And guys, as always, you know how it is. We'll see each other in the sixth dimension.
Yeah, we will. Okay.